So here we are. So we were, I believe this is foil 20, so has, yes? The light's too intense. Is that good? I believe we got up to this page last time, which was introducing JavaScript approached in a systematic fashion. And so we pointed out here that JavaScript had a single type of variable, which is defined by the var command, and you have to be a little careful joining strings and numbers together. There's quite an interesting example here. If you go to this example, which you can get to from the web, so they set a variable to be a string 555, and then they add 10 to the string, and they subtract 10 from the string. So if you add 10 to the string, you get 55510, because JavaScript assumes that everything is a string. If you subtract 10 from the string, you get 545, because JavaScript assumes that if you're subtracting, it must mean numbers. So that shows you how ingenious it is in its creative typing. So that, but it also shows how careful you have to be. So something which is quite important is this variable null, because null is how you test to see if you've actually defined something. And you do need that in some relatively sophisticated examples. All right, so the basic arithmetic is essentially the same as C and C++, Java and Perl. So you have these various assignment operators, which are the simplest variable equals something, and then you have plus equals, which says that the variable equals the original value plus whatever's on the right-hand side. Minus equals, which means it's equal to whatever it was, minus the right-hand side, and so on. And you also have this standard conditional expression that sets the value of status, in this example here, to be either adult or minor, depending on whether the variable age is greater than or equal to 18. And you can use, as usual, plus plus to mean increment something by one. So y equals plus plus x, increments x by one, and sets y to be the final value of x. So it has these standard shifting instructions with something which I guess I wasn't familiar with, which is probably standard, which is three greater than signs, meaning a right shift with a zero fill with two greater than signs, meaning a right shift, but just propagating the sign bit. And two less than signs is, as usual, a bitwise left shift. Now, we have logical operations which are bitwise, which are the AND sign, the OR sign, and the caret, which are AND, OR, and XOR, expressed in bit, thinking the arguments as a bunch of bits. So you will not actually usually use those. You usually would use logical operations on booleans, true and false, when they're called and, or. Those are the two standard ones. I don't think I've ever used in JavaScript the bitwise logical operations, but obviously there's some examples you might use them. So here the Boolean operations are in the middle. That's and, two and signs, two vertical bars for or, and the exclamation mark for not. Those are standard notation. And they must only operate on Boolean variables which are true or false. So in order to set Boolean variables, you often do comparisons. And in order to compare things, you use the comparison operators. And in some languages, those comparison operators are sensitive to type. In JavaScript, they're not. So equal is, so if you say A equal B, that will return true if and only if A and B are equal. So if you were doing that, say, in Perl, you would have to use equal if the numbers were numeric, and you'd have to use EQ if the numbers were string. But in JavaScript, there is no typing. So you use the same comparison operations, whatever the type. So comparisons are very straightforward as long as you know what you're doing. We've already actually illustrated in that adding of strings together the plus operator, which is a very important operator. It's the same meaning as in Java, it just joins things together. And unfortunately, Perl uses the dot operator to join things together. And I must admit, I write dot quite often in my JavaScript. And then JavaScript gets you an error message. So that's reasonably straightforward. Let's see if the examples are of any interest. So this is an extremely simple example of so this just sends a couple of variables equal to text strings and then adds them together as the first variable plus, and then in order to define a fixed string, it uses something separated by two quotes. And then it adds to that the second variable. I've already pointed out that if you wish to define strings in your JavaScript program, you can either use single quotes or double quotes, but you obviously must be consistent. If you start with a single quote, you have to end with a single quote. If you start with a double quote, you must end with a double quote. And typically you nest these so that if you have single quotes in your expressions, you must enclose that quote in double quotes. If you have single quotes and double quotes in one of your character strings, you must choose either the single or double quotes to define the character strings, and then put the backslash operator in front of the thing that you're using to delimitate, which is the standard way of doing it. Conditionals are more or less the same as normal languages. You can use else if, but only by noticing it's else followed by an if. There's no official syntax for else if in JavaScript. So the standard conditional says if some condition, then you follow it by a statement. You need a curly bracket enclosing the statement if the statement's more than one line long. You do not use the curly brackets if it's one line long. And then you can use an else operator, which is optional, and I say if can occur inside the else. So the way you do else if is by using if inside else. So the way you do loops is the same as in Java and C and essentially all languages. There's a for statement with an initial condition, a final condition to be which is the condition that has to be true while the loop is to be run, and then some expression to do increment, and then the statements to be executed are in curly brackets, and then there's a while statement which executes the curly brackets as long as the condition is true. And you can use break inside for loops to break out of the for loop, or break inside a while loop. And then there's a continue statement, which if you have a continue statement inside the body of a for or a while loop, it just goes to the end of that loop and starts the next iteration. So continue is the way you end the work you're doing on that iteration. Break is how you jump out of a for loop or a while loop. We come to something which is a little more interesting, which is the object model. And so JavaScript has a reasonably simple object model, which however is quite powerful. And as we'll see, it has a slightly confused syntax, which however is operationally quite easy to use. Now, you can officially define, if you listen to what Nancy described in the traditional object-oriented language, you can put in size objects, methods, and other objects. It is my impression that the object model in JavaScript is sufficiently deficient that it is not very useful to put methods in objects, because they do little more than copy methods from defined outside the object. So I might be wrong, but I have never found it useful to use a method inside an object. What is useful is to define objects inside objects. So I guess I think the best analogy could be the say a Unix file system, because the object structure in JavaScript is used in the same way as the Unix file system to define a hierarchical naming system. So you start off with in the case of Windows, you start off with a window called top, and then that window has a property called location, which contains its URL. It has another property called, frames of 0, which is the first frame in it, and then frames of 1 is the second frame, and then if you go inside that frames of 0, you come to another window which has all the same properties defined. So, effectively, objects are used in JavaScript to define a container for names, like a directory is used inside Unix, and you can essentially define an arbitrary hierarchical name for an object or a variable inside JavaScript by doing first, or second, or third, or fourth, or fifth, or sixth, or seventh. And those just done recursively, because any object in JavaScript can have another object as one of its so-called properties. So the things inside an object are called properties, and those can themselves be objects. So that's why it says here, an object is a container, which is what a directory is with a file system. And one particularly, there is also a syntax for arrays, which we'll describe a little later on, which is reasonably useful. So there's none of this stuff of inheritance and things like that. Let's see what examples we have here. just a table. Alright, so this basically comes from the JavaScript tutorial, which we have, which actually comes from Netscape Press, and this particular page describes the overall object hierarchy. So if you remember in Java, you started off with the object class as the top class. There's no such concept of that in JavaScript. But the thing that there's a much more operational hierarchy. So whereas the Java objects are described as a metaphysical space, the JavaScript objects are effectively defined in a space where the navigator, which is the browser, is the topmost object. So I mean, it's a physical. You're basically, that's why the Unix file system is a reasonable analogy, because you're describing physically the hierarchy of information in your web page. It starts off, I say, with the navigator object. There are, as we see, some other built-in objects not associated with the navigator object, like the math object and the string object, which are effectively separate trees of objects. And so this page here describes the various things that hang off the navigator object, like the name of the browser, the version of the browser, and stuff like that. And then underneath, there's also the so-called window object, and under the window there's the document object and the history object and stuff like that, and so on. The way you get these from the web page is you'll find a button called add-on. So when you go to this file, which is 24, you see an add-on button. You click that add-on button, you'll get that that example of an object. So as it says here, we have this general hierarchical name, which is rather different from Java, where the dot just represents the hierarchy. So again, compared to Unix file system, that dot is a slash in a Unix file system. You have directory 1, slash directory 2, slash directory 3, slash file name. Here we have dots separating the hierarchy, which is, of course, like Java. And as illustrated here, any member of that hierarchy can be an array. So they're either object names or an array index into an object name which has already been defined to be an array. And we'll describe how to define those. And some of Netscape's standard objects are arrays, like frames or images. You can also define your own arrays, which you can use for whatever purposes you want. Now, I said messages weren't terribly useful for the user. They are useful for the system. I mean, so methods, especially methods of particular objects, aren't particularly useful for the the user, because you can't really do anything with encapsulated methods, which are very interesting. But they are useful for the system to associate logically methods with the right place in the hierarchy. So when we get down to in the hierarchy to document, so that navigator.window.document, document has a method called writeln, which we've already seen, which writes a line followed by writes the argument, which is HTML, into the current document, which is the thing living in the current window. And so that's a method of the object, document object. Document, as I mentioned, has other properties, of which one of the most important is location. Location used to be a variable, but now it's a property. And it itself has a bunch of, it's now an object, it itself has a bunch of properties, like href and URL and things like that, which are the various things that define a location. So if you want the actual URL of a document, it's document.location.url. It's the URL of the current document. For instance, in the homework, which should have just got put up, now available, you'll use a method I introduced before called reload, and reload is a method of window, not of document, and so if you write window.reload, that is the method that reloads the current window. Sorry, it's a method of location, so I think it's window.location.reload. Some of the reasons I'm uncertain is that some of these things have changed between Netscape 2 and Netscape 3. The other problem is, as you see, that as I showed you this huge 6-inch thick manual, there are an enormous number of objects and methods and properties, and to remember what they are is quite hard. All right, so here is an example of a user defined function, and this user defined function is called setFrame. We've actually seen functions already, so this is just another example. And so this function is a function that loads a particular URL into a particular frame. And so it's called setFrame. It has two arguments. So you see the syntax. It's function, name of function, arguments in ordinary brackets, curly brackets, and the actual body of the function. The function does not have to have a return statement in it. So we see this statement here. So here I do some arithmetic. Actual URL is, I'm assuming there's some variable called base URL, which is defined the base URL, which I have to add relative URLs to. So I find the total URL by adding here the help.html, which is a relative URL to the base URL. Then I say top, which is, as we'll see, the topmost window in the browser, dotted into the object which labels a particular frame, dotted into location, dotted into href, and that is actually equal to the URL. You can use URL or href to define a URL. So this example illustrates another peculiar feature of JavaScript. When using arrays, you can sometimes refer to them by, you can index into arrays either by strings or by numbers. And it is a little unclear when you're allowed to do either of them. And for the frames array, Netscape allows you to index into the frame array either with the name of the frame. So for instance, here I put frame label equal to main display, which is going to be the name of the frame. I can either use that, or if this happened to be the first frame, I could write frames of 0. And those would be equivalent. In user-defined arrays, you must choose either to use indices or to use alphanumeric labels. This actually does something which has been implied by some of these things I've discussed. Is very important. The way that you, the usual way that you load a new page in JavaScript is to set the location variable of that page. So if you set the location variable of the page to a new location, that location gets loaded into that page. So this is a very interesting variable in that setting it actually causes action. So that says that JavaScript, as far as JavaScript is concerned, that's a very special variable because it actually triggers actions, not just storing a value. So you do not call a method to load a new page, although you can, because there's a replace method. But the normal way of doing it is just to set the location variable. So if you read the location variable, you get the current location. If you set it, you change it to a new location, and you load the corresponding URL into that page. So that's extremely important, because you need to do that very often. You often wish to have formed the URL by some mechanism, and you want to stick it in some frame or other. And as we've discussed, I think, many times, all this stuff should be put in the header, not in the body of the text, of the document, because things in the header are processed before everything in the body, and you want to make certain that these functions are actually known to Netscape before you use them, because otherwise you run into all sorts of trouble if you're not careful. Well, you get JavaScript errors. Let me see if there are any interesting examples. So this example here is a traditional mathematical example of the factorial routine. And so here you have a for loop running over I from 0 to 9, and then you can't read it. It says document.writeln, and it writes I factorial equals, and it calls factorial of I, and you notice the factorial of I calls itself. So this says that JavaScript supports standard recursive functions. Hopefully the number gets the answer right. Alright, so here's this slightly confusing JavaScript, but you can either call it the confusion of JavaScript or the economy of JavaScript, because JavaScript uses functions to define objects. So you can write a function which just returns factorial, and that's perfectly normal, but that will be called a method in Java. That's just like a function in most languages. But the same notation, function of some object, some name with arguments, is also used to define objects. And effectively, in the Java syntax, as I mentioned, it forms the role of the constructor for that object. So there is no difference, there is no class command, there is only a constructor. And so here's this example of an object which is meant to label, in the case I took it from was an example of how I labeled a menu, and a menu has a color for the menu, it has a preset selected menu item, it has a list of the number of items in the menu, and it has a list of the items. So if we look at this function make menu, it has two arguments, which is a sort of numerical number, so we can keep track of which number it is, and a name. So it has this overused syntax called this. So it says this.number equals number. You only, of course, need the this there to distinguish the argument NO from the internal variable NO. So you have this.NO equals number, this.name equals name. We're presetting the color to be black. If this is a constructor, you can always change the color later on by setting the name of the menu dot color equals red, or whatever we wanted to set it to. We say this dot menu selection equals 1, this dot count equals 0 for 0 items in the menu as the default. And we haven't actually done this, but it says this.options equals new array of an unknown. unknown number. So this allows us to, this, what this says is that we have in the make menu function, it has a property called options, which is an array, which is going to hold the labels of the menu, which will be so in order to use this, so we might have a menu called world menu, and that would say, we'll define that by world menu equals new, which is the same command as in Java, make menu, and then we might, this is the first menu, so it's 1, comma, and the name of this menu is world. So if I wanted to change the color of this menu to red, I would say world menu dot color equals red. If I wanted to set the values of the options, I could say world menu dot options of 0 equals this galaxy, and world menu dot options of 1 equals the next galaxy, and so on. So we get instances with the new command just as we do with Java. And so it's sort of got similarities and differences from Java. So here we effectively have this example of how we used it. As I mentioned, there is some historical confusion in that, at least in Netscape 2, if I've defined a family menu, if I define family menu as a new make menu, family menu of 0, which is an array notation, is the same as family menu.no, where family menu.no was, no was the first variable, first property defined in make menu. I believe that no longer works in Netscape 3. This corresponds to this rule that in Netscape you can define properties either by an array notation or by a variable name notation. However, some of the things that Netscape says don't work actually do work, and I'm not quite certain what's going to happen. But this used to work in Netscape 3, that you could use either an array notation or a dot notation, and they were the same, they meant the same. So as I say here, you can define encapsulated methods inside objects, but I haven't quite seen why that's terribly useful. But the claim is that there are some useful, this is useful at times. The reason why it's not useful is that the array methods can't access, as far as I know, any special way. They can't access the local data. They have to be global methods which access global data. But I don't believe, as far as I can see, you can use methods in JavaScript as you can in Java to do data hiding. All you can do is associate capabilities with objects. All right. So these are relatively, the next two statements are things which I actually haven't found useful particularly. So what this allows you to do is, this is just a notational convenience, namely if you have a lot of mathematical work, you can write with math, open curly bracket, and then every object inside that curly bracket is assumed to come from the math object. So pi, cos, and sine are members of the math object. Cos and sine are obviously functions, and pi is a variable or property. And so you do not have to say math.pi or math.cos or math.sine. I don't think this is very exciting because you could, I don't think that's terribly useful. So, all right, so you can, there is a variant of the for statement that uses a so-called in syntax. So you can say for a JavaScript variable, which is here called I, so you say var I to define a new variable called I in. So in is a technical, you know, a reserved word. And then you have the name of an object, and that basically gives you a for loop where I runs over all the properties in the object. So if you wanted to print out all the properties of the object, you can do this. So with the for notation, obj of in array notation of I is the ith object in the ith property, I should say, in the object obj. So here we defined a new type of object called car, which only has two properties, make and model. And then if we wanted to write out everything we needed to know about this particular car, we could use this for and in statement to run over all the properties of the car object. I have never used that particular syntax myself. So if you read JavaScript programs, you will find two notations for defining arrays, the so-called old method and the so-called new method. So my recommendation is that if you're using Netscape 3, which I assume you are, you only use the new method. However, you'll find most JavaScript existing on the web will use the old method. And even this latest Netscape Press book on JavaScript tells you to use the old method, not the new method. And it is about the only book, books come out every week, but as of a month ago, it was the only book that would even describe the new method. The new method was introduced in Netscape 3. So the new method is extremely straightforward. It uses a reserved syntax called array with a capital A, and you write name of an array equals new array, open curly bracket, close curly bracket, and you can define the length of an array in the curly brackets. However, that length is optional because it's sort of just a hint to JavaScript as to how long the array is, because you can have arbitrary length arrays with a new method of defining arrays. So here's a typical example of how arrays are used. So if you look at Java, so I mean, where would you use arrays? So if you think about it, there are lots of examples on web pages when you want to use arrays. So when you're making your fortune building your stockbroker page, you might want an array to hold all the stock, all the names of the stocks and all the prices of the stocks, and you would preload those into JavaScript arrays, and then you would do some arithmetic and manipulation with them to output them for your client. The example given on this foil here is where we have one array which runs over the states of the union, and another array that runs over the associated area codes. If there are two area codes per state, then the state appears more than once. So this allows you to build nifty pieces of JavaScript to prompt the user to associate the correct area code with some address. So if you have a form which has an address, by having these arrays preset, you can tell the user which area codes they're allowed to have for their particular address, so you can check that they've put in a reasonable phone number and stuff like that. So and also in that pizza example that say Nancy did, we could have arrays holding the types of pizzas or the types of toppings. If we're selling shirts, we could define the types of shirts. So there are lots of uses of arrays. Some of them are dynamic. For instance, this particular program here, or some variant of it, has an array that holds all the URLs that I've used in class in a particular lecture. And it just adds to it every time we access a new URL. So it's dynamically incremented as every time we click that button, it adds a new entry in that array. So that's an example where you want to use these dynamic arrays which automatically increase in size when necessary. So arrays have various properties and also various methods. The most important property is the length of the array, because that allows you to loop over it, and so that's area.length. So once you define your array, you can access the length of the array as area.length. If you have a sparse array, and you've only defined, say, area of 0, 1, and 203, you can test for that by looping over 0 to 203 and testing on that parameter I called null. So if something is not defined, it's equal to null. You say if area of I not equal to null, then do something. That will allow, otherwise, if you don't do that, you'll get error message from JavaScript, because you'll be accessing undefined variables. What JavaScript will call a property. Variables are essentially properties. So when you get a message saying an undefined property, that means you are accessing something which had not previously been defined, and the way you avoid that is testing on whether it equals to null, because there are some cases where you have to access a variable which might be undefined. What do we have? So this example here just illustrates this for these menus. So if I have a whole bunch of menus, I can set up an array of menus. So I define list of menus to be an array of menus. Then I can write list of menus of 0 equals a new menu object. This shows how you can have arrays of objects. You see here, we have simple arrays of just numbers and strings. With this syntax here, I can have an array of objects, which themselves can be arrays. If you remember that menu object had inside it an array called options. So this gives you multi-dimensional arrays. So the way you define you'd access that option will be list of menus of some index dotted into options of some other index. So this allows you to define arbitrarily complex hierarchy where you can have an array at any point, as far as I know, in that hierarchy. It's certainly, I think I've tested it probably up to 3 or 4th order arrays, and it's worked just fine. And you can do what you'd expect, namely, you can set list of menus of 0 to be a new menu object. And if you also wish to call it world menu, set world menu equals list of menus of 0, and world menu and list of menus of 0 point to the same object. Yes. It's the argument of the array operator. However, for the new method of defining arrays, it's increased dynamically. So it's a hint. Now, it probably sets up some amount of storage, and if you go over it, you have to put a pointer, and so it has to do pointer chasing to run through the array, so it's less efficient. So if you know your array is 100 elements long, you should write new array of 100. It's just a help to the interpreter. So the hash, the Java had that, I believe, for the hash table. Now, it's not like Fortran, where you have to have fixed length. Oh, I guess, see, you have fixed length arrays. These arrays are that Perl is like, Perl is the same as JavaScript. In Perl, arrays are basically taken care of by the interpreter. It will automatically allocate space. And in fact, it has to do that, you see, because we're allowing you to define sparse arrays where 0, 1, 2, and 203 are non-zero. So in order to, I don't know how JavaScript implements it, Perl implements that very efficiently, so it only uses four memory, like four cells to store an array with four non-zero elements, because it does it as some sort of linked list. Implementation dependence probably changes from versions of Netscape, one version of Netscape to another. If you presumably, if you say 100, it will allocate enough contiguous memory to store 100, which you can then just chase through trivially, and then it has a pointer at the end to the next chunk of memory it assigns. But probably Andreessen lets the programmers in the JavaScript group do whatever they feel is neat whenever they're writing this. Not defined. All that you know is the leap in principle is more efficient if you give it the right number. But it's meant to work whatever number you put in there, including leaving it out. Yes, it's dynamically changed. So this is a dynamic length. The same is true in Perl. The length of an array is dynamically changed in Perl and in JavaScript. So that's not true in Java. Java, you have fixed length arrays, which is, of course, why they're very efficient. But you can't, this is particularly, see, if you're having an interpreter, you have all this huge overhead anyway. So if something's a pointer, given I've got a factor of 1,000 over the direct access time anyway, because I'm running an interpreter, if I change a value to a pointer, that's a negligible overhead. So if I'm running interpreters, I should always use such, such types of arrays, because there's no point. The reason in Java or Fortran or C, which are compiled languages, that you have fixed length arrays is that then you can generate in the machine code an extremely efficient access of the value of the array. You take the base address and you add the increment to it, and that is the location. So that's one machine instruction. In Perl, you do one machine, you set up some sort of hash table or something which gets you to the 203th element, or else you just search a list of set elements. You have some algorithm, and then you then find the location of the 203rd array element, and you go there. So that has some overhead, which is almost certainly for the optimal algorithm logarithmic in the size of the array. So maybe that overhead 20 instructions. Well, we already had an overhead of 1,000 instructions to interpret the text string, which defined the array, and do everything else we had to do. So that overhead of 20 instructions in an interpreted language is negligible. So interpreted languages should have these more flexible constructs, because they might as well. So the concept, you know, this trade-off of performance versus flexibility is extremely different in a compiled language versus an interpreted language. Actually, I think that's a pretty interesting research issue. I don't believe people are brought up, like I was, with compiled languages rather than interpreted languages. But the trade-offs are very different in interpreted languages and from compiled languages. Where's my film? Here it is. All right, so the old way. So if you look at the JavaScript I've written, or most of the JavaScript on the web, it will use this way of defining an array. And the reason they use this way of defining an array, this is what JavaScript the old Netscape 2 JavaScript manual told us to do. It told us to define a function called makeArray, which had an argument called size, and it used this ingenious syntax to define effectively a fake array by defining an object which had size, which is now a fixed number, element properties assigned to it. So you define, so if you think about it, this function makeArray, which we then will create with new makeArray, and it must have an argument called size this time, because this is arrays done by hand, not arrays done by some native semantic. JavaScript, until a few months ago, just left out arrays, and you have to do it this way. And so you should, you only need to know this for reading existing JavaScript, which dominantly were used this way for defining arrays. And so you can see what it does. It says this dot length equals size. So that's so why do we do that? That's so that when we define something with the makeArray function, if I say Fred equals new makeArray of 100, Fred dot length is the length which is in this case 100. So we have the same operationally. Length is defined to be the same thing as before, and then it just assigns the set equal to 0. One in size number of elements, which is a this of I equals 0, with a for loop. If you wanted an array of objects, you would say this of I equals new, or whatever object you wanted. You just use some syntax to define this of I. So, for some reason, obviously it must have been a Fortran programmer who invented this part of JavaScript, because these arrays are defined so that they start at 1, because they put this dot length at the first definition in makeArray. And so actually, once you've done this, so if you say Fred equals new makeArray of 100, Fred of 0 is actually the same thing as its length, but Fred of 1 is the first element in the array. If it had been a C programmer, which had written the manual, they would have put this dot length after the for loop, which would then have made a Fred of 0 equal to the first element of this, and it would have made Fred of size, Fred of size equal to the length. So you could do either. Either was possible, but Netscape told us to do this. So everybody assumed that to be consistent, follow this syntax. So that still works. The old, because it's a legal JavaScript, so it's perfectly legal JavaScript. So people have not, as far as I know, changed to the new method of defining arrays. They still dominantly use the old method, which is so it's fine. But you should use the new method, as far as I know, because it's much more flexible, and presumably it's more logical than the old method, which is just a slightly peculiar use of the JavaScript function. You notice, I guess you should be now clear why I find the JavaScript slightly peculiar, the way they use functions. And you see there that we were able to use functions to define arrays, which is a rather remarkable concept, that we can use a function to be a function, which is a method. We can use a function to create new objects in some sort of hierarchy, and we can use a function to create an array. So it's sort of a very remarkable, flexible function definition that we have in JavaScript. As I've already mentioned, it's totally straightforward to define arbitrary multidimensional arrays, and they're done in the standard way they're done in Java, and which is not in the way they do it. Fortran multidimensional arrays are just contiguous lists. In Java or Perl or JavaScript, multidimensional arrays are arrays of pointers, essentially, or arrays of objects. So the way that a multidimensional array in JavaScript is an array of objects, And because the way you get it is that the list menus, which was an array, had a property inside it called options, which was also an array. And the way you get yet more cascading arrays is to have options and so on, defined to be an object which itself had arrays in it and so on. So the way you get multidimensional arrays is to define objects which are arrays of objects, which objects themselves contain properties which are arrays, and so on ad infinitum. So there are some useful methods which don't actually work in, well, they used not to work properly, but hopefully they do, they will very soon work properly. So there is a sort method attached to, so these are new arrays only. Old arrays, the make array has no special methods attached to it unless you attach them. So new arrays have three methods attached to them: reverse, which reverses the order in the array; join, which is actually quite useful. It takes all the elements in the array, replaces them by their string values, and an argument of join is a separator, which it then basically separates the values of the array. So if you have all the states, all the worlds, all the states of the union in an array, you can get a list of those states in alphabetical order by first sorting them, which is the first method it has. Then you join them, and then if you wanted to separate it with a blank, you just put a separator equal to a blank, and so on. And then you can write that out with the writeLn method onto your page. So that is meant to be illustrated here. So this is quite a nice example. So here we've been defined an array of presidents. We have 10 presidents from Washington through Tyler, and so we have various sort methods. And as again in, I don't actually know what Java does, but in Perl you're allowed to have arbitrary sorts by changing the sort method, the criteria for sorting you can do the same thing here. So here we have a button, so that when we click on this alphabetical button, it sorts the presidents in alphabetical order. If we press the chronological, it does it in chronological order, and in the order of name length, it should be in order of the number of characters in the name of the president. So that's done. So here we define. So when you did the click here, we have an onClick function called sortIt. And sortIt basically uses the intrinsic method sort of the array of the array object, and it gives the sort method a pointer to a comparison function, and these comparison functions are defined up here, but compare length and compare string. So that's a reasonably interesting method to look at. So actually, we now have the formal definition of an array. So actually the arguments of the array are the initial size and optionally the initial values, which you just put after each other. So if you want to define initial values, you can just put them in a string separated by commas after the initial size, which is the first argument of array. Okay. Now this is quite useful in JavaScript, which is there is a built-in property called arguments, which is actually an array, which is the number of arguments, which just holds the arguments of a function. So why is that useful? This allows you to have functions in JavaScript which have variable number of arguments. So you might have a function. This says that although you're instructed to place the arguments as I have here, x1, x2, I actually could have left those out and just found the arguments by calling by this syntax here. So if I have a function any old name, I then set var some object equals any old name dot arguments. That sets that to the property arguments. Then any odd name dot arguments, which is the same as argv dot length, is the number of arguments, and then any odd name dot arguments of 0 or argv of 0 is the first argument, and so on. And I have found it's quite convenient, just because in a lot of programming cases, it is quite convenient to write functions which have variable numbers of arguments, because they can have options, and sometimes you might need two arguments, and sometimes more or less, depending on the nature of the options. You can also find out where this function was called from. There is one slightly peculiar syntax. Well, maybe it's not peculiar, but anyway, you must have any odd name. You must have the name of the function there, else it will not work properly. And the argument cannot be used on its own. It must be the name of the function dotted into arguments, which is what you'd expect. I must admit, I'm never very clear about this keyword in many languages, because this refers to where we are now, and depending on how you think about it, depending on whether you're thinking of your window, or your form, or your function, it's not entirely clear what this means. It's not entirely clear to me. So we've seen an example of this already, in essentially these constructors, where it has the same syntax as Java, where this refers to arguments of the current function. When you write things for forms, this effectively corresponds, I believe, to the object within the form. So here you have an example of a link where we have an onClick, and this refers to that particular link object. It does not refer to the form which contains that. There wouldn't be a form. It does not refer to the document that contains that link object. If we actually just looked at this particular line, so let's see how this works. So if we look at this onClick, it calls a routine I wrote called setURL with this, where this refers to the JavaScript object, which is this link. If we look at up at this function, it notices that the JavaScript object called link has various properties, one of which is href, because when you write a link, you just say href equals something, name equals something, target equals something. So when I write, when I say set URL of obj, obj.target, that's entirely equivalent to writing in the HTML less than sign a target equals something. So this allows me to write a function which sets the target and href of this particular link. So this seems silly because I could have also put these variables, because here I only have preset objects to be the target and the href properties of a link. But if I, in a more interesting example, I would have used some arithmetic and probably some conditionals to decide which value of href and which particular target frame to use. So in the other, I mean, again, this is sort of looking a little ahead. We've already seen the so-called event handler on click, which basically is invoked when you click your mouse at that link. There's also a variable name called, there's also a handler called onMouseOver. If you know about, if you think about Netscape browsers, when you scan your mouse over a link, you see on the bottom some information, typically the URL corresponding to that link. So the way you do something like that so here I have onMouseOver, which invokes the event handler when the mouse is over the link, and then it says window.status, and so status is a property of the window object, and that property is the thing, is this stuff here, it's the stuff at the bottom of the browser, and so it sets the status, so this particular thing says sets the status line of the window to be URL set dynamically in subroutine set URL. You could have actually invoked set URL and find out, well, you could have invoked another routine which actually set the actual value of the URL if you wanted to and put it on the status line. There used to be a rule, I do not honestly know whether it's still true, that you must have a return true in such an event handler. So that illustrates several features. It illustrated how we could use this command here so that our function did set the target and href of this link, which is what we want to do. And then it also illustrated yet another event handler called onMouseOver, which is obviously a useful event handler. So there are some system functions called parseInt and parseFloat, and they're basically necessary because of the loose typing inside JavaScript. So as I pointed out, JavaScript has no typing, so if you wish to insist that something is an integer, you just stick it into the argument of parseInt, and parseInt returns an integer. And you can, you know, usually you want integers base 10, but if you wish for integers base 8, that 8 is the second argument of parseInt. So parseInt is a, notice parseInt is a system routine with more than, with a variable number of arguments. And so that the first statement in parseInt must be a statement defining the number of arguments. The number of arguments is 1, it sets the value of the radix to be 10. Otherwise it reads the radix from the second argument. And there are various rules that if it looks like a hexadecimal number, then the radix is 16. If it looks like an octal number, the radix is 8. And so this shows how to get, you know, we always teach our children that 1 plus 1 is 2. And as we pointed out, 1 plus 1 is sometimes 11 in JavaScript. But as long as we use parseInt, 1 plus 1 is always 2. So that's reassuring. And this parse float does the what you'd expect, say returns suitably floating point numbers. and there is a magic variable called NaN for not a number, which parses int and parses int, parses float will return when you give it garbage. So if you give Fred as the argument to parse int, it will return NaN, and not a number. Alright. So eval is a very useful function which used not to work. It worked to begin with, and then for about 6 months it didn't work, and now it claims that it works again. What eval does, it evaluates, it basically takes its argument and hands it to the JavaScript interpreter. So why is that useful? So the reason this is useful actually in all interpreters, this is a very general capability that most interpreters have. The reason why it's very useful is it allows you sort of one level of indirection in building JavaScript expressions. Namely, you can now, using eval, you can build your JavaScript expression dynamically. So if you think about most languages, if you want Fred.Jim.Harry, and you want to compare that to Fred.Jane.Harry, you have to write that string out as explicitly. And you say if person number equals zero, then it's Fred.Jane.Harry, otherwise it's Fred.Jim.Harry. But it will be much more elegant in many examples if you could construct the name dynamically as a text string and use that dynamically constructed name in the JavaScript instruction. So that's what eval allows you to do. Because eval allows you to construct the name and then put several names and hand those names to the interpreter. So this allows you to dynamically construct arbitrary JavaScript expressions and then have it interpreted. So it's sort of one level of indirection. So you can use JavaScript to construct a name, that's the argument of eval, and then that JavaScript constructed name is yet interpreted once more. So it's sort of double interpretation that you get with eval. And that's a good example of where that's useful is in constructing these complex properties of documents, because those documents are typically given labels for those properties, like forms and text and buttons in forms all have names, and it might be more convenient to construct that name dynamically using eval rather than writing out in gory detail the actual text for the name. So although it may not be entirely obvious, eval is a very useful function which, say, broke for about 6 months. Gave you error messages when you used it, and so that was rather frustrating. Alright. So I guess I'll probably finish here. So, as I've mentioned, the dominant important objects associated with JavaScript are those associated which we already sort of browse with the navigator, which is when under navigator we have window and document and all that stuff. There are seven other built-in objects in JavaScript. There's array, which we've done already. Boolean, I don't think is terribly interesting. There's a rather general function object which we'll discuss. There's a date object, which is almost identical to the Java date object. There's a math object, a number object, and a string object. And so we have, that says that in JavaScript we have eight sort of families of objects built in, each of which has a hierarchy, of which 90% of the complexity is in, or maybe 95% of the complexity is in the navigator hierarchy, and there's a little bit of complexity in these other built-in objects. And so that sort of illustrates why at the beginning of this discussion of JavaScript, I said that JavaScript can be thought of as a sort of language built around the manipulation of HTML documents. 95% or whatever it is of its complexity is in the objects and the methods associated with the navigator and everything that hangs off navigator, and it has these tiny other capabilities. Whereas if you look at C or Fortran or C++ or even Java, you have a much richer set of capabilities. So JavaScript has far more detail than those other languages on the window and HTML documents, and far less detail on all these other properties. It just has enough to, you know, it needs date because you might want to write the date on the document. It needs math because you might want to do some arithmetic with the form. It needs strings because strings are part of documents. And the rest, it certainly needs numbers. And we need arrays. So it just has the absolute minimum necessary to be able to manipulate documents. And that's all it has. So we will hopefully finish JavaScript next time, and there is a homework on the web for JavaScript.